Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Samir Dasani. In addition to having family ties in Pakistan, Samir has been researching and writing about military, religious, and cultural life in South Asia for the past 15 years. His articles include Power and Patronage, the Political Economy of Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Samir Dasani.
Thanks for having me.
And, of course, the former cricket legend Imran Khan, who's the head of the new PTI party, who fell from a crane. He's expected to make a full recovery, but he's fractured three vertebrae and a rib, and he appeared on television from his hospital bed. With the election coming up on Saturday, how do you think that's going to play, Samir? Is it going to make him, give him the sympathy vote, or make him look weak?
I don't think it'll be worse for Imran Khan's party than it would have been without that. It may be slightly better, but in any case, you know, his party was always expected to come in a fairly distant third place, and I think that's probably still the most likely scenario. From what I can tell in looking at the polls, it looks like the Pakistan Muslim League, which has a couple of factions, but the faction led by Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, is expected to come in top. The second position seems to be, according to the polls, the Pakistan People's Party, and then third would be Imran Khan's Tehreek-e-Insaf Party.
So in terms of being a spoiler, what kind of effect could they have, and are they having?
Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, what Imran Khan has had is had this party for many years, for more than 15 years, but only recently, so I'm talking about 2011 and 2012, only in that period has the party sort of emerged as this big sort of mass force against corruption. Its center is really in urban areas. It has a lot of sympathy among sort of urban and young urban people. But what Imran Khan has been doing in the last, say, 6 months to 6 to 18 months, I think, year and a half, he's really been going around villages and spreading his message, which is largely an anti-corruption and anti-status quo message. So the question will be not really, you know, if this party will gain enough votes to be spoilers, but rather, you know, will this party be willing to enter into a coalition? Because it's unlikely that one or the other, the Muslim League or the Pakistan People's Party, would have a clear majority. So the question would be, you know, would this, there may be kingmakers, maybe the right way to put it, and would they be willing to enter into some kind of a coalition government with a party that they accuse of corruption, and they accuse both of the mainstream parties of corruption? So that's the question that will be interesting to see.
Well, of course, the tragedy of Pakistan's politics, and a lot of people now are celebrating the fact that this will be the first democratic transfer from an elected government to another elected government because of the so many military coups and military governments. But it seems that the Pakistani people have had this Hobson's choice for some time between military rule, military dictatorship, and civilian kleptocracies, whose votes are based on a kind of feudal system that both Sharif and the Pakistan People's Party under Bhutto represent. And Bhutto himself, of course, was often derisively referred to as the bag man. So there's no end to corruption in the civilian politics. And indeed, there is some questions whether Imran Khan himself may well be a front for the military. So walk us through that, because, you know...
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no shortage of conspiracy theories in Pakistan. And I think that, you know, one says that and then one finds that some of these conspiracy theories do have some evidence. But I think in the case of Imran Khan, you know, we know a lot about the guy. We know what he was like as a cricket, you know, when he led the Pakistani cricket team. We know what his political platform has been like for the last 15 years. And I think it would be a mistake to see him as coming from the left or coming from sort of progressive forces. I think it's he's very center. I mean, his messaging has been very middle of the road, maybe center right if anything, because he seems to have made alliances with some of the more religious oriented parties and so on. Although those aren't really formal alliances, this is just what people sort of intuit. But what happened was, you know, in the wake of sort of vast movements in South Asia, in Bangladesh, and especially in India, against corruption, that movement, and then you had the Arab Spring happening in the Muslim world, in North Africa and in the Middle East. I think what we saw in 2011, 2012 was that Imran Khan kind of filled that vacuum. There was this real need for a leader who could speak out and say, look, you know, this is a government that's responsive to the needs of elites, feudal landlords in Sindh, Punjabi industrialists, and the military, and of course the United States. So either it's elites within the country, or it's a completely different country that it's accountable to, that the government is accountable to. And Imran Khan played that role. He played it very well. Whether he is more pro-military or less pro-military than others, it's difficult to say. Other people have track records. Both the Muslim League and the PPP have their own track records, not particularly good track records, as you mentioned. I think if you go back to Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto in the 1970s, he is the last leader with whom, for whom, I can say, the Pakistani public feels a lot of resonance. When they take his name, I'm referring now to Benazir Bhutto's father, of course. When they take his name, they sort of take it with some kind of reverence. This is someone who really tried to put in place policies that would be pro-Pakistan, pro-poor people, and so on. Those policies, as you mentioned, weren't actually allowed to flourish because right away in 1978 you had a military coup and Zia-ul-Haq came to power backed by the United States. Zia-ul-Haq and the United States were sort of the two forces that were responsible for turning Pakistan into what it is today, a sort of a feudal and hyper-religious backwater in many ways, with a nuclear-armed backwater, if you like. So, you know, there's this tragic history of military dictators, U.S.-backed military dictators, and then civilian governments that have always been had some level of corruption. But I don't think corruption is the real problem. I mean, I think the question is to what extent, you know, even corrupt governments can be responsive to, you know, local needs, local priorities, and so on. So if Asif Zardari, the former prime minister who used to be called Mr. 10%, if his only crime was sort of skimming off the top, I think many Pakistanis wouldn't see that as the most serious offense. I think the most serious offense is that Pakistan's development strategy, Pakistan's sort of anti-poverty strategy, has just never been put on track. And I think one reason that it's never been put on track is because leaders, whether civilian leaders or military leaders, have not been able or willing to question the role of sort of feudal structures of this massive landlord system, and now the role of the military. The military is itself the largest landlord in Pakistan. So until you're willing to attack those power structures, you're not really going to be able to end poverty.
And again, I'm speaking with Samir Dasani. In addition to having family ties in Pakistan, Samir has been researching and writing about military, religious, and cultural life in South Asia for the past 15 years. His articles include Power and Patronage, the Political Economy of Pakistan. So obviously, Imran Khan, is, as you pointed out, is not going to win this election, but he may be a future leader or at least a future force in Pakistan's politics. Will he, isn't he pretty much a representative of the elite? He may be against corruption, but he's certainly a part of the privileged class, and it's endemic, as you've pointed out. And until the wealthy in that country show some social responsibility and even pay taxes, which they don't do, and until you break up this feudal landlord system, and as you point out, the army, which the old joke is, Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country, those are very tall orders, are they not?
No, these are tall orders. I mean, no one would downplay those. And like I say, I mean, Imran Khan, although he does have an anti-corruption agenda, it's not clear to me that he has a sort of transformational agenda around transforming the nature of Pakistan's economy or around... the other thing to say is that, you know, if he was vocal about that kind of thing, if he was vocally challenging the power of the army or challenging the power of landlords in Sindh and Punjab, you know, I think there are those probably among his advisors who would be saying, look, don't be too vocal about your political stances on some of these things, because you need U.S. support, you need the support of landlords, you need the support of political elites to get anywhere. And then once you're there, if you want to have a political agenda, you can have it. So there's all this, and that's the other thing that he's probably hearing is, you know, you don't want to be assassinated for taking the wrong political positions. And in a place where, you know, Benazir Bhutto was assassinated about 5 years ago, and it's not exactly clear why or who even to this day. And just last week, we had a situation where the lawyer who was investigating, who was trying to find out who it was who actually shot, who actually detonated the bomb that killed Benazir Bhutto, that lawyer was killed. So the situation is very unstable, and people are careful about expressing what they think too publicly for fear of either losing power or just simply being killed.
Well, the Pakistan Taliban have been active blowing up political candidates and trying to assassinate them, particularly the Awami National Party. So that's the amazing part of what's happening in Pakistan, is how the state seems to be under such flagrant attack. You had the whole Swat Valley invasion, etc. And where does the secular and religious divide stand now? You know, there's a lot of fear in the West that it'll become an Islamic country with nuclear bombs. But then you have the secular forces seem to be corrupt, and you can understand why poor people would be attracted to religion in the absence of any justice. So give me your analysis of where the secular vis-a-vis the religious forces stand today.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. You know, Pakistan's first leader, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, was not a particularly religious person. In fact, you know, he himself had a long history in terms of being an anti-British freedom fighter in India. But so he is someone who, he was a Muslim, but he drank wine, he ate pork, these kind of things, right? And then you have the situation where, because the country was founded based on religion, so it didn't have a perceived space for Hindus or for Sikhs. Two things have happened. One is that the minority communities, because there are Sikhs, there are Hindus, there are Christians there, the minority communities are heavily persecuted, are heavily targeted. And secondly, there's been an increased radicalization. And actually, I misspoke in a way when I say that comes from the beginning, from 1948, from Pakistan's independence. That actually doesn't come until the late 1970s. And so you have this alliance between the military dictator, Zia-ul-Haq, and the U.S. And the U.S. was putting a lot of money into the sort of Talibanization, is what we would call it today, but that's not the right word in that context, towards making Pakistan a much more religious fundamentalist country, in the hope of stirring up all this religious fervor so that they'd go and kill, you know, Soviets in Afghanistan, was the rhetoric in those days. So this is very much a monster that the CIA has created, and I think now they're kind of appalled at what they've created. Of course, what's happened in recent years, as U.S. funding has gone down, Saudi funding has gone up. And so we have that sort of, you know, the money dedicated to sort of radicalization and fundamentalist efforts in Pakistan, the money has not dried up. The money is very much there. Whereas if you're trying to open a school, if you're trying to, you know, if you're trying to work, for example, with minority communities, if you're trying to do some of the work that we try and do in our efforts in Pakistan, it's very, very difficult. It's hard to raise resources. It's hard to have access. Infrastructure needs are very great. It's hard to go to some of these places. But if you want guns, if you want weapons, they're very easy to find.
But what happened to the Kerry Lugar money? Because I know that got demagogued a lot by the press there. We were talking about it being a kind of stalking horse for Blackwater and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Where does it stand now, the money? I mean, a lot of it hasn't been spent, has it?
No. I mean, U.S. aid to Pakistan is an interesting story. It's always, the problem has largely been absorption. The problem has largely been that the U.S. is willing to give money, but Pakistan isn't always ready to spend it. And then there's other questions. So Kerry Lugar may be a more transparent, you know, issue. But there are also things like the CIA's black budget. There are also things like the relationship between the U.S. and the ISI, the Pakistani Security Agency, and so on, which we just don't know. I mean, a lot of people suspect things. A lot of people, you know, wonder about how the ISI has become such a you know, one of the three or four most massive intelligence agencies on the planet. And it, you know, so we know that there's sort of U.S. money somewhere there, but it's hard to prove exactly what's going on. So look, the ties, the monetary ties between the U.S. and Pakistan are just very complicated, and they're very much there. That presence is huge.
Well, but they're contributing to a black economy. But the black economy exists, does it not? It's a Pakistani black economy. It involves the military, the ISI, drug trade, you name it, right?
Absolutely. No, I think at this point in history, we can say it's a Pakistani economy. But I think, you know, if we look from 1980, that black economy didn't really exist. And so I think we have to say, okay, what happened between, say, 1975, 1978, until, say, 2000, when that economy was maybe the majority of the economy. I think it's largely to do with the U.S. setting up the system of madrasas. It's largely to do with the U.S. funding its war against the Soviet Union. And you're right. In the last 10 years, it's very much taken on a sort of an independent existence. But even in the last 10 years, we have the case after 9/11 of the U.S. needing to push Pakistan and push General Musharraf in a direction that was opposed to the will of 99% of the Pakistani population. And the only way it could do that was with, you know, huge bribes. So even in the last decade, this has been a system that's been supported by the U.S.
And exacerbated by the Saudis, or continued, the worst part of it. They're essentially funding the Taliban and the madrasa system.
That's right? True. That's true. And for me, you know, because of the close links between, you know, U.S. and Saudi geopolitical interests, it's hard to know where to draw that line. And for many people in the Muslim
that's
world...
Well, that's a big, by the way, that's a huge dilemma and a question that I keep trying to find answers to. Are the U.S. just incredibly stupid? Are the Saudis so duplicitous that they can con us at every turn, which is what they're doing in Syria? You know, they're supporting the Al-Qaeda people there. You know, that is a huge question. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but...
No, I think you're asking exactly the right question because, you know... So Syria is an interesting example. I mean, I don't think the Saudis are doing whatever it is they're doing without the explicit or implicit blessing of the United States. So in the case of Syria, it's, you know, the Saudis are backing a proxy war with the blessing of the U.S. In the case of Pakistan, or even Bangladesh or the region in general, I think the Saudi presence, you know, for us who live there, it's toxic. But I think for the U.S., I think the U.S. sees this as one way to sort of increase its presence to some extent. I'm not actually sure that the U.S. has a long-term strategy, but right. I do see that there are ties between U.S. military strategies and some of this sort of funding of fundamentalist groups. And I can say not just Muslim fundamentalist groups. It's also the Hindu fundamentalist groups, which are also, you know, increasingly strong in India, which also seem to have some U.S. backing as well.
Well, it sure sounds counterintuitive and counterproductive to support the Taliban, these Taliban types, who are the most implacable enemy the U.S. has. And we're supposed to have this so-called war on terror going on, and they're enemy number one. So it is puzzling to figure out what these Machiavellian motives are here. But just in closing then, Samir Dosani, what is your sense then of, just back to this election on Saturday, what, there are 172 seats. What do you think that Imran Khan will end up with, what, about 40?
Yeah, look, I won't make predictions in terms of seats or even in terms of percentages. But, I mean, it does seem likely that Imran Khan's party is definitely going to be in third place. I think we have, you know, a situation in Pakistan where, you know, the PPP is very strongly entrenched in certain regions, those regions being Sindh and Balochistan. And the Muslim League is strongly entrenched in other regions, namely Punjab. And so because of those sort of political machines, those are the two parties that are likely to come up with the most seats. Whether either of them will have enough to form a government seems unlikely. And so therefore, Imran Khan's Tehreek-e-Insaf party really becomes the key to this whole thing. If they're willing to go in coalition, whichever group they go into coalition with is likely to be the ruling party.
And they'll have some leverage. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Samir Dosani.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Samir Dosani. In addition to having family ties in Pakistan, Samir has been researching and writing about military, religious, and cultural life in South Asia for the past 15 years. His articles include Power and Patronage, The Political Economy of Pakistan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down in America.